This is the third time I've been here in a gospel meeting. I just so appreciate the church here. I appreciate you letting me come and speak for you. I've been hearing all the comments about the young people, and I'm just very, very impressed with your young people. Last time I was here, they were young people. Now they've grown older. But now you have a new crop of young people. I preached at Claremont for 37 years, and I've gone through about four or five generations there, and it's always thrilling to me to see godly young people. And so I appreciate the young and the old here today. The theme of our meeting this week is Christianity 101, the basics about discipleship. And I want to talk to you this morning in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, chapter 3, 2 and 3 about in his time. We're going to look in this sermon at how God controls the world. And then in the other two sermons today, we'll be looking at his eternal purpose to save lost sinners. You know, a lot of people think the book of Ecclesiastes, that the book of Ecclesiastes is a cynical and a negative, pessimistic book. But that's because they don't understand Solomon's viewpoint. Solomon starts in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and he tells us that everything is vanity and useless and empty. But the problem is he's looking at life under the sun. That phrase is used 29 times in this book. Under the sun is man's perspective when he leaves God out of the picture. But if we go above the sun and look in chapter 12 and verse 13 that we're to fear God and keep his commandments, then we can enjoy life and we can be satisfied with what God provides for us in our temporary life here on earth. But as we look at that overview of Ecclesiastes, we come to chapter 3. And chapter 3 is an interesting chapter, because in the first nine verses, we see the contradictions of life. And we see this confounding or this bafflement as we read these verses. Ecclesiastes 3 verses 1 through 9 is probably one of the best known passages of Scripture. These words, the lyrics, were in the song Turn, Turn, Turn that was sung by the rock group, The Byrds, in 1965. But very few people really understand the meaning of Ecclesiastes 3 verses 1 through 9. These verses are not saying that there is a time that God appoints to us and he wants us to go to war and he wants us to make peace, that there's a time for us to weep and there's a time for us to cry. That's not what he's saying at all. In fact, the key word here in these first nine verses is time. It's used 30 times in the New American Standard Version. And what he's looking at is a ceaseless reiteration of the words time. That's intended to indicate his sense of monotony of all things. In chapter 3, verses 2 through 8, he gives us 14 pairs of polar opposites. They're employed to cover every aspect of human life. The fact that Solomon utilized polar opposites in a multiple of seven began, first of all, with birth and then death. I think that's highly significant. The number seven signifies completeness. And so here we have the totality covering every area of life. And I know you're wondering what some of these lines mean in verses 1 through 9. This idea of to kill, what's that mean? Or to hate later on in those verses in verse 8. The teacher isn't prescribing that we take time out of our lives to kill, or we take time out of our lives to hate, and so on. He's saying when you look at life as a whole, all of these things show up at one time or another, and they contradict each other. In chapter 3 and verse 1, there's a time for everything, and a season for every activity under the sun. Between the time man enters through the gateway of birth and exits through the portals of death, he passes through a succession of constantly shifting experiences. Whatever experience a man has, he can count on having the opposite experience before he leaves this world. The world we live in is a jumble of contradictions. And we look at those contradictions in our life and they jar us a great deal, don't they? Sometimes we're at war, that is, we're killing. Sometimes we're at peace, that is, we're trying to heal. The killing is an intentional act to end life. And the healing refers to the idea of preserving a life. Sometimes we're weeping and sometimes we're laughing. Sometimes we're mourning and sometimes we're dancing. Sometimes we're grabbing up stones and sometimes we're casting them away. And so we have all these contradictory experiences that we go through in our life. How do we usually view these contradictory experiences in our life? Well, there's a lot of confusion about it. I mean, life is so perplexing and confusing. From an under-the-sun viewpoint, nothing makes sense in our lives, does it? It's hard to figure out what life is all about with all these shifting, contradictory experiences. And when the sinner looks at all of this, you know what he does? He gets frustrated because of all these changing experiences in his life. But the person who has the lifestyle of a disciple, which we're talking about this week, the person who is a follower of God, he accepts the fact. He accepts the fact that the things that are unexpected will happen in life, and that life isn't always going to go according to our game plan. The experiences of life under the sun can never yield sufficient insight to fully determine God's true character and the way He orders this world, the way that He deals with men. Impenetrable mysteries will always plague those who refuse to look beyond this present evil world, as Galatians 1 and verse 4 says. This list in chapter 3, verses 1 through 9, there are three things about this list. First of all, I don't want everything on this list. I like one side more than the other. I love births, but I'm not a big fan of death. And I like healing, killing not so much. I love peace, but not hatred or war in my life. But the preacher, he looks at life and he says, life is going to have pretty much everything on this list, from birth to death, from war to peace. And so you better get used to it. The second thing about this list, I don't get to say what I want on this list. We'd all like to choose some of these things and not others, but we are not going to have a say about that. It's out of our control. And thirdly, when you add it all up, it adds up to nothing. Death cancels out birth, killing cancels out healing, and war cancels out love. And with all of this canceling out of each other, you know what that leads to? It leads to the complexity. In chapter 3 and verse 9, he says, what do people really get for all their hard work? He's just repeating what he said back in chapter 1 and verse 3. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he labors under the sun? And so what Solomon is saying is all this effort really worth it? If everything cancels out each other, what lasting profit is there in living this life under the sun? I mean, since man is subject to many contradictory experiences over which he has no real control, what kind of security, what kind of peace can we have in our life under the sun? That really is a rhetorical question that expects a negative answer. We think, why should I work so hard when it's all going to be destroyed anyway? It's only when Solomon adjusted his sights here in chapter 3, and he no longer looked at life under the sun, but he looked above the sun by bringing God into the picture, that he gained a new perspective. The contradictions of life. But on the other hand, I want you to see the contentment of God's people. I want you to see the choice that we have. In chapter 3 and verse 11, he said, God's made everything beautiful for its own time. And that word everything is resuming what he said back in chapter 3 and verse 1. There's a time for everything. Whether we like it or not, God has set us in this kind of world where things don't always make sense to us from an under-the-sun perspective. And the way we respond to that, we can whine all the time about the contradictions and the seeming unfairness of life. Or as we live the lifestyle of a disciple, we can trust God and be content. In chapter 3 and verse 11, Solomon said it'd be better to choose that latter option, to trust God and be content. And even though we may not like all the seemingly contradictory experiences and circumstances of life, the arrangement of the world by God is right. And so in chapter 3 and verse 10, I've seen the burden or the task that God has placed on all of us, yet God has made everything beautiful for its own time. These verses right here are like a seatbelt that will help us hang on through all the rough and the tumble things that we're going to experience in our lives. And though man travails over the unsolvable difficulties, the truth of the matter is there's nothing wrong as far as God's control and His purpose over this universe. God administers everything perfectly. And Solomon says we just need to trust Him. By His control, everything is beautiful in its time. A harmony of purpose pervades all the issues of life to such an extent that we can stand back and we can admire the control that God exercises over His creation. And it's true, we can't figure out all the mysteries of life, but one day we will understand. But for now, the circumstances in which we live, we're not able to penetrate those mysteries. We just can't understand how God can bring beauty out of our circumstances in life. But in this under the sun existence, God never intended for us to be able to fully explain all the things that happen, all the circumstances of this life. But God helps us. You see what He does? He helps us to look past this life under the sun by looking above the sun to what He's given us. You know what He's given us? He's set eternity, or He's planted eternity in the human heart. He's given us minds that look beyond the daily events to the total sweep of life. We are able to see the timeless from the time bound under the sun. We get an inkling from within because we're made in the image of God. We know that this earth is not all that there is. In every man is the instinct that there's someone in control. And even though there's a lot of injustices and contradictions in this life, that one day it's all going to be balanced out. If I look strictly at life as it's laid out before me, under the sun without God, if I fail to see the circumstances of my life through the lens of faith, then I curse and I swear and I fight. But in the lifestyle of the disciple, when I see through his eyes and his time, the beautiful picture is all going to come together. And when I can view life like that, young people, when I can view life like that, I can give Him praise. And I see purpose in tragedy. And I see reason in calamity. And I see His sovereign hand at work as He reminds me that He's still in charge. And out of this, I acknowledge my greater dependence upon Him. And as I do that, I willingly relinquish the controls to Him. Brother Ricketts, that's so easy to say. So easy to say. So hard to do. You know what I do? I preach for a living. I need to practice what I preach. You know how many calamities we've had in Claremont over the years I've been there? I mean, just brain cancer, all kinds of cancers, tragedies. It's just gone on and on and on. I think I've done more studying about suffering than any other subject in the years I've been preaching, because we've been afflicted with it. But we're not the only ones. You've been afflicted with it too. And every church I see, I used to think it was just us. Every church I see goes through this. Chapter 3 and verse 11. He's planted eternity in the human heart. But even so, people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. We see enough of what God's doing to recognize His purpose in all of this. But the grand design escapes us. We can never stand back far enough to view it all as the Creator does, whole and entire. Our problem is, as we live in this life under the sun existence, that we focus on the wrong thing. We see the fuzzy, ugly cocoon. God plans and sets in motion the beautiful butterfly. What we see today, God is working on forever. We get caught up in the wrapping, and He focuses on the gift, the substance down inside. We look at the external, and He looks at the internal. And He makes all things beautiful in His time, including loss, including death, including a hospital experience, including failures, including brokenness and battles and fragmented dreams and lost romances. Young people, you ever been through that? I did when I was in college. It's heartbreaking. Headaches, illness, heartaches. Whatever you're going through this morning, let me give you hope. He makes it beautiful in His time. I found something on the internet the other day, and I really like it. It's profound. Just because you don't see anything happening yet doesn't mean that God's not working on it. Without God, life is purposeless and profitless. Life is miserable and meaningless. But with God, Solomon tells us, ultimately, everything makes sense. And because that's true, we can have cheerfulness. In chapter 3 and verse 12, so I concluded there's nothing better than to be happy and enjoy ourselves as long as we can. Yes, there's perplexities in life, but even in spite of that, life can be enjoyable now. There's nothing better, Solomon said, than for us to rejoice. You ever seen a person who didn't have God in their life? Have you ever seen them truly enjoying God on a continual basis? The only one who enjoys the gift of life is the disciple, the follower of God. You know why that is? Because God alone can give the perspective and the refreshing hope needed to sustain our life of joy regardless of the circumstances surrounding us. I've said about joy before that joy is an internal thing. It doesn't matter what the external circumstances may be, we can still have joy and we can have peace. They're all internal things. In chapter 3 and verse 12, he goes on to say, there's nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live. God says He gives us the ability to do good in our lifetime. And let me urge you not to wait. Now is the time to do something good. We don't do anyone a bit of good when we're 6 feet under. It's all over then. And so don't wait until then to make life happier for someone else or to give someone else financial relief or to help someone through a hard time. We need to do good now. God says He gives us the ability to do it in our lifetime. He said it's a gift from Him. You ever seen a person who is really selfish and lived for himself? And then someone contacted him about the gospel. And they began studying about it. And he became a follower of God. And now he's given a capacity he didn't have when he wasn't a Christian. He has a capacity to do good. And that means the ability to do good without being thanked and getting credit or receiving applause. Can I give all of us a challenge this week? I'm going to tell you ahead of time, it's a hard challenge. Challenge is this. Do one good thing this week without telling anyone else about it. That's more of a challenge than we may think. Because we're kind of programmed to get credit for what we do. And so Solomon says we are motivated to do good because God gives us the ability and He expects us to do that. The third point I want you to see is the confession in chapter 3 and verse 13. And people should eat and drink and enjoy the fruits of their labor, for these are gifts from God. Solomon is saying we state our dependence on God by confessing that He gives us the appetite to eat and drink. This is the gift of appetite, the ability to enjoy our food. So many of us take that for granted. You ever been in a nursing home with someone? They've lost their ability to swallow. One of our elders had that happen to him. He died a few days later. Couldn't even taste the food. Couldn't even swallow. This perspective is called a gift from God. Because only those who believe in Him and accept His Word are able to think this way. That all the good things come from God. And they can enjoy the fruits of their labor. God gives us the ability to see good in our labor. The under the sun perspective says, I earn what I get. The above the sun perspective says, God gives me what I don't deserve. And so I'm going to view my job in the right way and not complain. Because it's a gift from God. In verse 14, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing can be taken from it. What he's saying there is we're not going to get a correct perspective unless we go above the sun, unless we seek answers from God. God wants us to empty our hearts of our own efforts and our own searchings to understand the perplexities of life. And what he wants us to do is to learn to trust him and to accept that he knows exactly what he's doing. That in spite of all those things that disturb us at times, in spite of all those things that makes us curious at times, in spite of all of those things that we don't understand, that God is at work, and when he's reached the conclusion of the matter, that everything will come out just exactly as it ought to. And that in spite of these perplexities of life, that ultimately God is going to bring beauty out of them. And in verse 14, God does that so that men will revere him. God wants us to be humbled enough to come to him with hearts made empty from our efforts to understand the perplexities of life. In fact, God made the world like he did and ordered the world like he did and all the circumstances of the world. He ordered all of that so that we would fear and reverence and revere him. Truly a God who is able to accomplish his purposes and protect his people and punish the wicked, even with all the changes and the variations that happened in this life. Surely he's to be held in awe and greatly respected and revered. So in verse 15, what is happening now has happened before, and what will happen in the future has happened before, because God makes the same things happen over and over again. That's a little bit difficult to understand, but I think what he's saying is this, that God patiently repeats things in the history of mankind. He repeats them until they're learned. Most men will look at life as a monotony. But for those who seek God, they understand there's profit under the sun. With God in the picture, there's a purpose. From God's perspective, whatever exists or occurs in the present or in the future has previously occurred in the past in a similar form or fashion. And so he seeks the past. You know why? Because it fits exactly the circumstances of the present time. That's not a futile view of life. It's a sober estimate of how God is able to balance out events in the world to accomplish and fulfill his purposes. And so we've seen the contradictions of life. We've seen the contentment of God's people. But now in the end of the chapter, he's going to throw something at us that's just going to make our head spin. Because he talks about the certainty of death. In this section, he's going to talk about when life is unfair and when injustice exists in the courts where it shouldn't. We know about that in our day and time, don't we? I want you to notice the challenge he issues in verse 16. And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. And the question comes up, Barry, you've just been talking about God being in control, but how can he be in control over the world when there's so much evil in our world, when the wicked are prospering in their sin and the righteous are suffering in their obedience? Under the sun, the innocent not only at times suffer justice delayed, but they suffer justice denied. And someone says, well, how can we reconcile this with a world that a righteous and holy God is running? How do you reconcile that? It's an old question. Job asked the question. Asaph asked the question in Psalm 73. Habakkuk asked the question in his prophecy. But in verse 17, the preacher balances it out for us. He ascends above the invisible world, and he goes above the sun, and he reaches beyond his physical sight as he looks at the circumstances of life and the injustices in life. He looks above that and he shows his faith in God. And so I want you to see the confidence that he shows. In verse 17, I thought in my heart, God will bring judgment, both to judgment, both the righteous and the wicked, For there will be a time for every activity and a time for every deed. You know what that is? That is one of the greatest affirmations of faith found in the Bible. The other one is found in Job. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. That's an affirmation of faith. Solomon is saying, I believe God will work this all out. I don't know how. The circumstances of life, the puzzles, the perplexities, they're not being worked out now. It isn't fair. You know, when my girls were in high school, they come home and say, Dad, Mom, it's not fair. And we wouldn't allow them to say that. That's what this world is. It isn't fair. It isn't fair. But I believe God is in control, that He's going to bring beauty out of all of this. I have confidence in God that although what I see now is not justice but wickedness, that God is going to bring the wicked into judgment. There are no statutes of limitations on divine judgment. And death will not clear the docket. God is just. And God always brings justice. And so we look thirdly at the commentary. In verse 18, Solomon said, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. Solomon answers with a natural follow-up question. He said, you know, if God intends to deal equitably with men, why does He let men die unvindicated and unpunished? In verse 18, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. The reason God does that is because it's a winnowing test to reveal the hearts of mankind. I know that justice delayed emboldens the wicked to further evil. Solomon even talked about that in chapter 8 and verse 11. And so that's how the wicked view it. But the righteous, the follower of God, the one who is living the lifestyle of a disciple, you know what he does? He humbles himself. And it moves him to a greater trust in God. So why this aspect of death? Why are men taken down to the dust? Well, justice may not exist under the sun. But we just read in verses 16 and 17 that God will at last judge all men. Verses 19 and 20, for that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they all have one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All go into one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. And because that's true, death not only cannot frustrate God's righteous judgment, But God uses that to help men to see that they're not gods, that they're not all-powerful, they're not self-sufficient, but that in least one manner they are like the animals. Made of dust, they return to the dust. And so what does death do for us? Death, as a gracious warning, is intended to open the hearts of men to their true nature and draw them out of their sinful rebellion against God and draw them back unto God. But there's no question that we share with animals the same substance, which is destined for the grave. As far as the life of flesh is concerned, we have no advantage over the beast. And man may boast about all of his achievements, but we can't escape what happens to the beast after death. He will return to the dust. And so in verse 21, who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth. Even though they both return to dust after death, men and animals do not have the same experience at death, because man's spirit goes to God, chapter 12 and verse 7, while the spirit of the beast simply ceases to exist. You say, Barry, that's so easy to say, but how do you know that's true? How do you know that's true? All of what I've just said has to be accepted by faith. Chapter 12, verses 13 and 14 tells us what happens to man after death, depending upon the attitude he has toward God in this life. Let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole
Duty is added by our translator. This is the whole. I like that better. The whole. This is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. In verse 22, Solomon says, "So I saw that there is nothing better for people than to be happy in their work." That's why we're here. No one will bring us back from death to enjoy life after we die. And so he concludes this chapter by repeating what he said in verse 12. "I know that there's nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live." Men that are vulnerable to grave injustices and powerless before the forces of nature, what should they do about all that? They should trust God to make all things right at last. And in the meantime, just live joyfully in His present gifts. And sure, young people, there is injustice in this world, and things aren't always fair. What are you going to do about that? You're going to be cynical? You're going to be bitter? You're going to complain the rest of your life? Solomon said, why not just make the best of the present and cheerfully enjoy what God provides without anxious care for the future? We need to reject self-pity and revenge and resentment and retaliation. What we need to do is to discover advantages to our disadvantages. I like these PowerPoints here. We're all going to die, so enjoy life now. And that looks like something I could enjoy a whole lot right there. And then what should you do when life is unfair? Well, just give it to God. And in the meantime, as you're living under the sun, God said, I've given you the gift to enjoy life. If we'll just have that attitude, who knows what impact we will have on others who are struggling with the same questions and their perplexities in the circumstances of life. We constantly bump into people every day that are submerged in self-pity. All they can do is tell us how wrong this was, or how unfair he was, or how someone broke his promise, or how this man broke up the partnership and took me to the cleaners, and on and on and on ad nauseum. Solomon says, I suggest to you that there's nothing better than to look for an advantage and dwell on it. To make that your life's purpose and message. And if you'll do that, who knows what impact you're going to have on others. God's going to take care of control in this world. Why fret and be in turmoil all the time? Enjoy what God has provided. And let Him take care of the injustices of life. We've looked this morning at how God controls everything in this mixed-up world. But the person seeking Christ has to put aside the world and look only to Jesus Christ. I want you to turn your psalm books, if you would, to 398, I believe it is. 398. Mark Bingham, Mark, if you'll lead that for us, 398. But before we do that, I want to tell you about my grandson. He was born to an unwanted mother. My son-in-law and daughter had been wanting to have a baby, several miscarriages. And so finally, through a number of circumstances, they found out about the baby. And the mother and the biological mother and her mother met with Ashley and Jason. And they said they're a perfect fit. And so they named him Maverick. And Jason liked Top Gun, so they named him Maverick after that. And Maverick, I'll still remember, over in Dade City when he was born, we went in the room where they had the little bassinet there. And the nurse was fussing, was dealing with him. He was fussing. And I didn't think anything about it at the time, but he didn't want to be touched. A couple years later, we found out he had autism. We're very, very blessed because he has mild autism. What did Maverick ever do to deserve autism? I would give my life for that boy. I love him so much. And we have such a bond. I can deal with that one of two ways. I say, life is so unfair. And I can gripe and I complain all I want to about that. What good is that going to do anybody?
Every day I pray, every prayer I pray, I mention Him. And I say, God, I pleaded with You, I begged You, but not my will. Your will always be done. And I remember what Abraham said, will not the God of all the earth do right? And that in His time, that I'm trusting Him to work it out. Now, Maverick, since he's going to be 6 next month, he's never spoken a complete sentence. He's spoken a word here and there, but never a complete sentence. I hope before I die I'm able to hear Maverick say a complete sentence. But it's going to be in God's time. And so what I do in the meantime, I just trust Him. That's the only way I can live my life. It's the only way I can go on with my life. Otherwise, I'm going to be miserable. He brings such joy to our life. I hope he's able to come this week. He's such a beautiful young boy. But whatever perplexity you're facing this morning, you got to trust God. That's the only way you're going to make it.